In this lecture, we're going to continue our discussion of the Puritans and focus primarily on the question of Puritan-Indian relations. But I'd like to start by tying up some loose ends from the first lecture on the Puritans, just to point out that Puritan settlement in 17th century New England was not in fact confined to Massachusetts proper, that it did begin to move beyond those confines right away in the 1630s. We already began to see the settlements of New Haven in present-day Connecticut, and the settlement of Connecticut, which was a separate settlement consisting of a number of towns, including Hartford. We might say that the Connecticut settlement was somewhat more liberal than Massachusetts Bay was, and New Haven was, to some extent, more conservative than Massachusetts Bay. But by and large, it is safe to say that nevertheless, these were sister colonies. They were all Bible commonwealths. They shared basically the same principles and organizational structure. Only Rhode Island, really, is where you see some kind of difference in the way the colony is organized and the foundational principles on which it's based. And we've already seen that Rhode Island sort of got its start as a source of settlement for people who were exiled from colonial Massachusetts, and that indeed was a major source of population for them. Rhode Island, by the later 1630s, consisted of maybe five towns, among them the best known, Providence, and it was these that Roger Williams later merged together to create what became Rhode Island. And in Rhode Island, we see more or less a commitment to the principle of religious liberty, and more or less a commitment to the principle of the separation of church and state. So here there is, this is the outlier colony from the point of view of New England as a whole. Now, I want to talk about Puritan-Indian relations, which is a controversial subject even today and was controversial among scholars for many years, continues to be, although I think people would be surprised if they read what modern scholars are saying about the Puritans, because I think we're all sort of the opinion that the Puritans were basically two-faced, treacherous people who piously held up the Bible but really just wanted to exterminate the heathen. I understand completely why people believe this. The Puritans were quite politically incorrect. There's not much for modern historians to like in the Puritans, so it's very easy for them to be caricatured. But what we've seen among historians over the past several decades is that historians who specialize in writing general histories of the U.S. have continued to perpetuate the usual sort of hostile renditions of Puritan history. But specialists who focus on the Puritans and focus on their wars and their relations with the native peoples, in other words, people who write for the professional historical journals, have been much more sympathetic to the Puritans over the years as they've sifted through the evidence. Now, when I was in college, when I was an undergrad at Harvard, we read, in addition to a great many other books, in particular, we were urged to read two books on this subject. And one of them was Alden Vaughan's book, Alden Vaughan, V-A-U-G-H-A-N. Alden Vaughan's book is called New England Frontier, Puritans and Indians, 1620 to 1675. Now, in that book, you get a much more sympathetic account of the Puritans and their interaction with the Indians than you would get in American popular culture. Now, to the contrary, the other book that we read, Francis Jennings's book, The Invasion of America, puts the Puritans in the most negative light possible. And in fact, I recall when I read it, being struck at the author's statements from time to time that, well, I'm sure the Puritans did such and such. I don't have the evidence for it because they probably destroyed the evidence. Well, as a historian, you can't really do that. You have to deal with what you have. So I want to focus here on some arguments that the Vaughan school might make, simply because they're so unusual in that we don't hear this type of argument very often. We usually hear just the demonization of the Puritans. And that's not to say that the Puritans were without blemish. Certainly Vaughan would be the last person to say that. But I think because we hear the other side so often, it's useful as a corrective to hear the Vaughan side of the story. And I strongly recommend you read the book, A New England Frontier, particularly in one of the later editions, so that you can read his forewords, prefaces to the later editions, where he brings you up to date on the state of scholarship and gives you scholarly references if you want to pursue them. So let's start with a little background. In 1616 and 1617, a terrible epidemic decimated the native population of New England, so that by the time the Pilgrims arrived in Plymouth in 1620, there were perhaps between 15,000 and 18,000 natives living in all of New England. So that was a very low population density, maybe 0.22 people per square mile. All of these native peoples were Algonquins, which meant that they could, the various tribes, communicate with each other at a very basic level, but there were substantial language barriers that nevertheless existed between them. Now, when we look at the Puritan testimonies regarding the Indians, what we find is a mixed picture. Neither unremitting praise nor harsh condemnation. So we do see, for example, the Puritans freely acknowledging the generosity and kindness of the Algonquins, their willingness to help those in need. There were numerous cases of them lending a hand to Englishmen who were lost or shipwrecked. But then there were also criticisms. And the criticisms basically can be boiled down to this, that the Indians are lazy drunkards. That was what the Puritans said. Well, lazy, that's a little bit hard to explain away in terms of being a just accusation on the part of the Puritans. If you look at the lifestyle of the Indian women, they were extremely hardworking and carried out the backbreaking work of the household. The Indian men were very hardworking during the hunting season and when there was any type of emergency. But the drunkard accusation is a little trickier, because this is an accusation that the Indians leveled even at themselves, that we see even in their own testimonies. They speak of the difficulties here. They did not have the equivalent of strong drink. And it's true, the Puritans were not libertarians, and they believed that it would be irresponsible, given the fact that the Indians had not experienced something like this before, to just promiscuously distribute alcoholic beverages to them. And so there were attempts to keep them out of the hands of the Indians. They lived at basically a subsistence level. And I say this not to be disparaging, but just as a historical fact, that they more or less lived in the material conditions that we would associate with the Stone Age. So the key Puritan aim with regard to keeping peace with the Indians was to keep both alcoholic beverages and weapons out of the hands of the Indians. And in the case of the latter regulation, they were really just upholding the king's own demands, that he likewise wanted to see the weapons of the Europeans kept out of Indian hands. Now, contrary to popular belief, the Puritans did in fact go to great lengths to try to ensure that their own people did not mistreat the natives. Now, and I realize that in saying that, I sound incredibly naive, sounds like the exact opposite of everything that we've all been taught, and I understand the skepticism. How could I possibly be telling the truth here? But the documentary evidence to this effect is quite substantial, and I might point, for instance, to the case of Thomas Morton, whom Plymouth had had some trouble with earlier in the 1620s. We can talk about that in the discussion section if you like. But Morton in 1629 returned to New England and wanted to take one of the canoes, an Indian canoe, and he fired a charge of hail shot at them when they refused to just hand over the canoe, and then he grabbed the canoe and left after injuring somebody and damaging some property. Well, Massachusetts ordered him to make restitution to the Indians and in fact burned his house to the ground and sent him off as a prisoner back to England. And I want to share with you their statement regarding Thomas Morton. It's quite something. This is from the Alden Vaughan book. Thomas Morton shall presently be sent prisoner into England. All his goods shall be seized upon to defray the charge of his transportation, payment of his debts, and to give satisfaction to the Indians for a canoe he unjustly took from them, and that his house, after the goods are taken out, shall be burnt down to the ground in the sight of the Indians for their satisfaction, for many wrongs he hath done to them from time to time. Well, during the terrible epidemic from 1633 to 1634, the Puritans, in fact, tended to the Indian sick and buried their dead and even welcomed orphans into their homes. Now, let's move now to the subject of the Puritans and Indian land. And on this subject, I will admit no dissent whatsoever, because it is absolutely not true that the Puritans simply seized the land from the Indians, or they tricked them into giving it up, or any such thing as this. This is not sustainable based on the historical evidence. Historians who specialize in this area would laugh at this proposition, but the conventional wisdom, of course, is that Europeans are always treating the natives unjustly. So therefore, we can just sort of make this as a blanket accusation against all Europeans. And that's ridiculously ahistorical and unfair. So I will admit no dissent on this question. It is absolutely true that the Puritans acquired Indian land through voluntary cession that both sides understood completely. Now, I understand why people might think that the Puritans must have just grabbed the land. Because, of course, we have this view that the Puritans were a bunch of Bible-thumping hypocrites who claim they believed in peace and brotherhood, but they were just there to exterminate the heathen. I understand why people believe that. Likewise, it's true, the Indians started off with all the land, and at the very end they had relatively little land, so it must have been taken from them by some kind of subterfuge, or they must have been tricked into giving it up, or tempted by worthless trinkets, or they didn't understand what private property and land was, or they only understood communal ownership of land, whatever. None of this is true. All those claims are false. Anthropologists have not found any Indians in colonial New England who held land in common or didn't understand the concept of private property and land. If you look at these deeds, they're very detailed. There's very little room for misunderstandings. But we should pause briefly here to note, well, what did then happen to the Indians? I mean, you look at they had, you know, 15,000 to 18,000 of them, and then there were even fewer. Weren't they just exterminated and sent away by the Puritans? Well, how did they actually perish? Well, about 15% of them perished in the various wars, either among themselves or with the Europeans. But mostly it was either general migration to some other place, or they were decimated by waves of disease, epidemics. And the irony is that the more the Puritans tried to help them, the worse it got. Because the more the Indians engaged in peaceful relations with the Europeans, the worse it got. Because the more likely they were to contract these diseases. So Indians who went to Harvard, for example, which was understood as a university for both Europeans and Indians, were decimated. Indians who went to schools that were set up by Europeans to educate them were decimated. So that, by and large, is the explanation of what happened to them numbers-wise. Now, what happened to them land-wise was, we have to remember that they lived in a very primitive society, materially speaking. They've got more land than they could ever possibly use or want to use. So who are we to stand in moral judgment of them when they decide, well, you know what, I think instead of having 50 gazillion acres of land I'm never going to use, I'd much rather have a metal plow or an iron plow or a knife made out of metal or a hoe or any of these implements that would make my life much easier, basically in a Neolithic society. And that, in fact, is what was happening. The Indians, in fact, typically approached the Puritans, offering to sell them land, and especially in the Connecticut Valley region. The Puritans were welcomed into the Connecticut Valley because it was thought that they would be able to serve as a buffer against the hated and violent Pequot tribe. Now, Puritan courts typically ruled in favor of the Indians when they appeared before Puritan courts arguing that somebody had unjustly appropriated their land or there was some ambiguity in a deed. It was very, very common for the Indians to win their cases in Puritan courts. This is not, this is something I think that the Puritans deserve credit for. Now, it's true, the Puritans wanted to convert the Indians. They did not want to exterminate them all. They thought that the Indians may, in fact, be one of the lost tribes of Israel. It's their obligation to convert them, not kill them all. But they wanted to convert them to Christianity. And, of course, that is very politically incorrect. So that, again, leads us to have prejudice against them and treat them unfairly as historians. But we can't do that. As historians, we have to believe in equality. That is, everyone deserves to be treated equally in the eyes of history. We all have to look, look at the motivations of people and not just impose our own motivations on them or what we imagine their motivations must have been. We have to be very scrupulous about finding out what they really believed themselves to be doing. So when we look at the missionary activity of the Puritans, it's difficult for people in the 21st century to have sympathy for this. So therefore, they think that the Puritans were just hypocritical jerks. But let's consider the man who was referred to as the apostle to the Indians, John Eliot. Now, John Eliot first came up with the idea in 1647 of translating the entire Old and New Testaments into Algonquin. Now, the difficulty with this is Algonquin did not even have a written language. So that meant John Eliot first had to learn Algonquin and learn it basically just by sitting around listening to it. Learn it, then invent a written language for them, and then translate the entire Bible, Old and New Testament, into that written language. So presumably, if all the Puritans wanted to do was oppress and kill the Indians, you'd think there would be a lot easier ways of doing it than that. I mean, that just seems like an impossibility. And yet, by the early 1660s, he had done it. He had, in fact, translated the Bible. There were established a group of what were called praying towns. About 14 of them were set up, so that the Indians who were pursuing Christianity could be self-governing, with some basic oversight, but by and large self-governing, and they would be away from the influences of the other Indians, but also away from the influences of the Europeans. This was one of the ways that the Puritans interacted with them, was to establish these praying towns, and also to establish Harvard College in 1636. If you look at its charter, in 1650, it makes clear that this is an institution for the education of Europeans and of Indians alike. This is going to be the Oxford or Cambridge of the Indians. And finally, I want to say, just with regard to the question of the Puritan treatment of the Indians, the Puritans were not racists. I mean, you hear this on every college campus from people who have never read anything about or by the Puritans. They were racists, because by definition, all Europeans are racists. In fact, they weren't in this case, because the Indians, they believed, were white. They did not believe, the Puritans did not believe that the Indians were a separate race from them. They believed that the Indians were whites, that simply it was the effect of the sun that had colored their skins, but they did not believe that they were some separate race that was inferior to them. I mean, they did believe that from a civilizational point of view, that they themselves were superior to the Indians. They were more advanced and they had a more sophisticated society. They believed that. That's true, but that's not because of so-called racism, because they believed that the Indians were of the same race with them. And likewise, the various Indian tribes did not conceive of themselves as belonging to a single race. They did not think that way. So when we look at the various wars that took place between the Europeans and the Indians, they're not really so simple and comic bookish as the Europeans on the one side and the Indians on the other. there were always Indians siding with the Europeans, particularly, as I hinted at earlier, the Pequots, the Pequot tribe, was viewed. These people came from the area around the Hudson and eventually pushed into Connecticut, and they had been considered invaders by the other tribes from that moment on. And so other tribes were interested in wooing the Europeans as potential allies against the aggressive Pequots. So now I want to move into what, in fact, led up to the terrible event and atrocity known as the Pequot War of 1637. What were the origins of that? Well, it all began in the spring of 1634. The Pequot's first white victims were Captains John Stone and Walter Norton and their seven-man crew. Now, the exact circumstances of this were unclear. John Stone was thought of very poorly by the Europeans themselves. Everybody who met him thought badly of him. He was from Virginia, and he would take his ship up and down the coast, and he would often help himself to people's property. So he was some kind of scoundrel and not particularly well thought of. He was looking to find out whether the Connecticut Valley might be a good trading spot, and he and his fellow captain and crew wound up dead. Well, why? Why had they been killed? The Puritans believed that Stone had been killed in his sleep, treacherously. But then the Pequots made overtures to the Puritans to communicate to them their version of the story. And in their version of the story, Stone had seized and bound two of their people. Now, incidentally, the reason that the Pequots were so anxious to make this overture to the Puritans to let their side of the story be known was that at that time the Pequots found themselves at war both with the Dutch and with the Narragansett tribe. So the possibility that the Puritans could also go to war with them because they're upset at the murder of these Europeans, well, just seemed like too fearful a prospect. That was just one enemy too many. So they wanted to make amends for this and to explain what they believe happened. Well, the earnestness with which the Pequots related their version of events led the Puritans basically to accept that the Pequots were telling them the truth. And in fact, a peace treaty was worked out between the Pequots and the Puritans. And that treaty had numerous provisions. That trading relations would be opened between these peoples, that two of the assassins of Stone and his crew would be turned over to the Puritans for justice to be carried out. Also, the Puritans, as I said, had been encouraged to move into the Connecticut Valley region by non-Pequot Indians. And the Pequots had begun trying to block this. And so part of the treaty established that the Pequots would stop doing that, would allow the free settlement of Puritans into the Connecticut Valley region. Well, with the passage of time, it was clear the Pequots were not holding up their end of the treaty. They were not turning over the executioners of Stone and his crew. They were not allowing the continued settlement of Europeans into the Connecticut Valley. And the Puritans began to grow restless. But the straw that broke the camel's back was what happened when a trader named John Oldham was found dead on Block Island. Now, when that happened, Captain John Endicott was sent by the Puritans in Massachusetts with 90 volunteers to Block Island to seek revenge. And it was relatively lightly defended, so there were few casualties, but still, great property damage was done. Canoes were burned, cornfields were burned, wigwams were burned. And then they proceeded to Pequot Harbor for 2 days' worth of just unremitting destruction. By the time Endicott returned to Boston, the Pequots were then engaged in revenge upon the Connecticut Puritan settlements. It was those people who bore the brunt of the Pequots' revenge. Now, word and eventually about 30 Puritans, including women and children, were killed by the Pequots in these reprisals. Now, word eventually reached the Puritans that a proposed alliance between the Puritans and the Narragansett tribe was in the cards. And so at that point, the Puritans, if you can believe the nerve they had, they appealed to Roger Williams, the guy they had thrown out, who had a very good relationship with the Narragansetts, to prevent this alliance from coming to fruition. And Williams agreed to do this, and in fact, not only was he successful in preventing the Pequots and Narragansetts from aligning with each other, but he actually managed to bring about an alliance between the Narragansetts and the Puritans themselves. So the key precipitating factor in what became the Pequot War was the harshness of that initial Endicott expedition. And it's interesting to note that the Plymouth settlement had condemned the Endicott expedition. The Connecticut Puritan settlements had condemned the Endicott expedition. So even the Puritans themselves were by no means of one mind on this matter. Well, the main battle now in the war between the Puritans and their Indian allies against the Pequots, the so-called Pequot War, the main battle was the Battle of Mystic Fort. And this was a horrific slaughter. It was basically the Pequots were surrounded in this fort, and the Puritans set fire to it. So the Pequots were killed either by being burned alive or because the Puritans had formed a circle around the fort. When they tried to flee, they were gunned down. And the exact numbers of deaths are not known, but it was somewhere between 400 and 700. So it was a horrific, terrible atrocity, horrific thing, men, women, and children killed. So the Puritan victory was decisive, and it tipped the balance of power in New England. The remaining Pequots were, not all the Pequots were just exterminated. It wasn't a genocide in that sense. But they were not allowed to continue as Pequots. They had to be absorbed into other tribes. Now, having said this, I want to make note of one incident, though, that I do think says something about the Puritans and the Indians that I think helps us to take a more nuanced view of what might otherwise be a very one-sided view. And again, it's not to say that the Puritans are stainless or without sin themselves. Obviously, the battle at Mystic Fort is a pretty horrific thing. It's very hard to justify shooting people who are fleeing a burning structure. But still, as historians, we have an obligation to muddy the waters, not to make things simple, but to make them complicated. And so I want to conclude with the episode of the Wethersfield Massacre, and to talk to you about what happened there. And here I want to read to you an excerpt from the Alden Vaughan book, New England Frontier, and I think you'll be quite interested in this. Here's Alden Vaughan speaking. He says, "The most remarkable evidence of Puritan impartiality is to be found in an episode connected with the Pequot War. The massacre of 9 settlers, including women and children, at Wethersfield, Connecticut in 1637 had been the final atrocity before the River Colony's declaration of war. It later became known that the local Wangunk tribe, led by Chief Sequin, had invited the Pequots to make the raid and had thereby actively conspired against the English. Sequin and his tribe were guilty not only of abetting the enemy at the cost of many English lives, but they had violated their covenant with the Wethersfield settlers in doing so. It would not have been surprising had Sequin and the Wangunks felt the full force of Puritan revenge when the truth became known. The logic of the situation would seem to demand that the Wangunks share the fate of the Pequots. Had the Wethersfield settlers been free to act as they saw fit, Sequin and his followers would probably have suffered for their perfidy. But revenge could not be taken without the approval of the general court, and when the issue was brought before it in the spring of 1638, the Wangunk sachem received a full debate and hearing. Séguin defended himself by claiming that he had acted against the English only after they had wronged him. He professed to have sold land to the original settlers in 1635 on the understanding that he and his tribesmen might remain in the area and receive protection from the English against the Pequots, for the Wangunks, like the other river tribes, had long resented the harsh hegemony of Sassacus and his followers. Unfortunately for Séguin, however, the settlers at Wethersfield either did not understand the terms of the purchase or chose to ignore them. When Séguin set up a wigwam at Wethersfield early in 1637, he was driven out by force. In fury, the Wangunk chief had turned to his former enemies, the Pequots, for assistance in redressing his grievance. His argument threw the Connecticut magistrates into a quandary. In denying Séguin the right to settle within the bounds of Wethersfield, the settlers had been unjust. In return, the Wangunk sachem had caused the death of 9 of the English, a heavy destruction of property, and untold human suffering on the part of the 2 captives and the surviving families. Could such a violent crime be justified by the earlier and relatively milder English wrong? Uncertain themselves, the leaders of the river colony wrote to Massachusetts for advice. Whatever one may think of Puritan intolerance in matters of religious dissent, there is good reason to applaud the Bay Colony's restrained approach to this problem. Governor Winthrop called in, quote, such magistrates and elders as could meet on the sudden, and presented the question to him. They answered that Séguin, having been the recipient of the first wrong, had been justified in retaliating either by force or fraud. The magnitude of his revenge was irrelevant, they said. Nor had he forfeited that right by not waiting for a peaceful adjustment of his complaint, because he had objected to the injury done him, and his pleas had been ignored. Séguin had observed his side of the covenant, the Wethersfield English had violated theirs, and must accept the ensuing horrors. This opinion of the Bay Colony spokesman did not bind Connecticut, but at a meeting of the General Court on April 5, 1638, the Connecticut magistrates announced themselves in full agreement with their neighbor's advice. After a thorough hearing of the evidence, the court decreed that while each party had inflicted injuries on the other, quote, yet because the first breach was on the English part, all former wrongs whatsoever are remitted on both sides, and the said Séguin is again received in amity to the said English. Connecticut and Massachusetts thus joined Plymouth in giving dramatic demonstration that Puritan justice was disinterested and binding upon all. And so I leave you with that example, that we realize that all the sin and iniquity was not on one side, but was shared by everyone, as is usually the case in stories of the human condition.